Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with the articulate actor-singer George Ball. Listen to the way he sidestepped a career in opera and created a unique career, one tailor-made for him, and how, now, as he is turning 80, he launches his very first solo CD. It's an amazing story told by a remarkable man. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about being who you really are, not being who you think you had to be or should be, or other people told you you must be, or who other people are. No, being who you really are. This, it seems to me, as a psychotherapist, is much harder than it sounds. In my experience, most of us are living what I call our cover story. That is a version of the truth. It is the truth, but it is not the whole truth, because so many of us have been forced by experiences in our young life to deny, hide, pretend that some things about us are not true. So, if you want to hear more about my ideas about this, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. You can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can talk to me. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. You might notice that I am speaking very quickly, more quickly than I usually do. And that is because this interview that I'm going to do, if you've been listening, you know, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And this interview with George Ball is an example of that, a glaring, clear, high-lit neon sign example of someone who virtually from the very beginning of his life, knew who he was, what worked for him, what didn't work for him, what felt good, what didn't feel good. And although there may be some second guessing about what he might have done, how he might have done it, actually it seems to me that this is a man who had a through line, who always knew what he could do, what would work for him, and he honored it. It's a very long interview, but I didn't want to cut any more than I did, and also I wanted to include a particular cut from the CD called Think of Me. Today is the launch of George's CD, and the cut I wanted to play is the one he talks about, the one with the extraordinary arrangement by Michelle Brauerman. It is their version of Some Enchanted Evening, and I wanted to get that into the show. I will go out on that. But at this time, I simply want to introduce George Ball.
Okay, I'm here with George Ball in his extraordinary house in Ojai, surrounded by many dogs.
Fur.
Much fur.
Much fur.
Much fur. Yes, I know this one. And I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Okay, so do you call yourself an actor, an entertainer, a performer? What are you, if people ask
I'm an actor who also sings.
So I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the very first time in your life that it occurred to you that performing, having people look at you, having a different character, making things up, any of that was attractive, called you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember it very well.
Yeah?
Although I, as a little kid, as a wee little kid, before I started school, I had this thing where I could listen to a song on the radio.
Right.
And when it was over, I could sing it back to you, words and music. It just...
All right, how old?
Four.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. Three, four.
So the initial draw was to music.
Oh, yeah, most assuredly so.
So it's interesting that you say sort of as an afterthought, you know, an actor who sings, but...
It's not an afterthought at all.
No, clearly.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's an extraordinary thing.
It was extraordinary. I didn't know it, and nobody told me that it was.
Really? They didn't say...
No, my mother loved music, and she played the piano a little bit, and it was kind of a musical family. Everybody liked to sing, and there were no performers, per se, but... But they liked music, and I loved the radio, and I loved wind-up Victrolas records and
yeah.
Things like that.
So they had a lot of records.
Oh, yeah, and my aunts had buku records. There was a record player down in my grandmother's basement, and I used to get down there and just sit, wind it up, and play record after record.
You were, how old were you then?
I was probably grade school.
Okay, so from the very beginning... You are clearly...
I remember a specific incident.
Uh-huh.
My first day of school, first grade, we had a homeroom class, and then the very first class that we had was a music class. The teacher said, what I'd like to do is have each of you sing a scale for me. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do ti, la, sol, fa, mi, re, do. Well, about half the people... kids
couldn't do it.
I couldn't wait till she got to me. Oh. And she got to me, and I sang it. And she called my mother and said, you know this boy is gifted. And my mother said, yeah, I think he is. And she said, we need to get him into a choir. There was a very, very famous boys' choir in Pittsburgh called the Trinity Cathedral. And teacher took me down there, and I sang for the choir.
And how old were you then?
I was first grade.
Oh, my goodness. Five?
Six.
Yeah.
Six.
Six?
Yeah. Took me down. I sang for the guy. And I became a member of the Trinity Cathedral Boys Choir. And we sang in department store balconies at Christmas and blah, 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 and on and on. And that became it. I mean, I just knew that that's where I was pointed. And by the time I got to junior high school and I got the lead in the operetta, Hansel and Gretel, played the father, and I was in the class plays. I was a member of the ensemble, which is a boiled down group of the choir, and I also was part of an even smaller group of four boys who formed a quartet. So, and I was the soloist with the high school choir.
So it was all about singing.
Acting too. The junior high school was Hansel and Gretel, the operetta, which was all acting.
Right. Okay, so
Plays.
Yeah, so you began to be in the plays.
In seventh grade.
Okay, that was natural for you as well.
Completely.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were performing. You were just a performer. You came in performing, essentially.
Well, it was something that I knew I could do. I didn't, you know, it was there.
Right.
I got a lot of attention because I did it, which, you know, that's good. Hey, look at me, Mom. You know?
Yeah, no kidding.
And I really liked it. We also did, like, we did class plays, which were not music, and I did those, too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I probably did the lead in the class plays when I was a sophomore, junior, and senior.
Okay, so did you know, were you saying to yourself, this is what I'm going to do, or, right?
Mm-hmm.
And your family all understood that this was what you were going to do?
Well, actually, my family was just sort of accepting of it. That's
mm-hmm.
what I did.
Right,
you know?
Right. So that's who you were, that's what you did. It wasn't
no
a big deal.
Oh, no.
Right. Okay.
Not at
all. All right. So, high school, you're in the plays, you're
mm-hmm.
in the choir, you're
mm-hmm.
singing, right? Okay. Were you studying any of this?
Well, when I got out of high school, there was a woman, she discovered me, sort of. She said, we have to do something about you. And she got me a voice teacher. Old Russian, wonderful voice teacher named Boris Dobrovolsky. He was opera, and he taught opera, and he was the best friend and teacher when he was in Russia of Chelapin, the great Russian basso. So he had legitimacy.
Mm-hmm.
He had cards. And so I started studying with him, and then this was out of high school. He got me into the Pittsburgh Opera Company's chorus. And then
high school?
Yeah, I was probably 20.
Goodness.
21. So he got me into that operatic chorus. And at the same time we were working on arias and so on. Because great for the voice, and I've never had voice problems because of him. And then he said to me, the Metropolitan Opera has a contest every year, and I would like you to enter it. So I learned a couple of arias, and the Metropolitan Opera auditions took place in towns all over the country, and then who won moved on to the next and moved on to the next. And I won.
You won?
The judge called me aside afterward and said, you know, if you want a career in opera, you can have one. And I said, I don't know about that yet. It's too soon. She said, well, whatever, I'm just telling you.
You were still very young.
I was 23.
But that's not too young to be making a choice about a career in opera. So you
Oh, hell no.
What were you thinking about for yourself?
I wasn't thinking anything because I didn't really know what I wanted to do yet. I went to the next level, which was in Cleveland, Ohio, and I went with my teacher, and he played for me. And when we got there, he became very disturbed very quickly. And I said, "What's the matter? What's going on, Boris?" He said, "This is not going to work out. You're not going to win." And I said, why is that, Boris? And he said, because the young man who's the lover of the conductor of the Metropolitan Opera's orchestra, and he's the judge, he's going to win. And he was right. I didn't win, but I did get a very bad taste in my mouth, and I didn't like the people. I didn't like being around them. They all took themselves way too seriously. And then I went back to the choral because, he loved me to do that so much. And so I went back, and I went back to the Pittsburgh Opera Company's chorus. And sure enough, I'm approached by a guy who says, you know, that if you want to do some smaller roles and so on and so forth, you would do well to join Mr. Karp's workshop. It's $500. Well, it was a hell
right.
of a lot.
Yeah.
And that gave me another. I went, what? If I'm good enough to have smaller roles, I don't need to take his workshop. So anyway, I just weaned myself away from opera, even though I had won a contest. I was pretty damn good.
And people kept telling you that you could. So yeah, so I'm just curious, that your disillusionment with it, was it partly the politics of who the guy was going
to
win?
It wasn't bad. It was, I didn't like the people. I found them to be phony, and I didn't have a good time with them.
You know, I've heard in my interviews a lot the significance of finding a group that you feel like you are like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not so young anymore, 23.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
when I went in the Army.
You went into the Army?
Well, we got drafted.
Oh.
I won all the Army talent contests when I was in the Army. I won in Bremerhaven, I won in Berlin. And I lost in Heidelberg, only they asked me to stay with them and tour with them, so I toured with them. And
so you were performing, essentially. You were...
I was singing.
You were singing.
That was singing.
Mm-hmm.
There was no acting.
Acting,
or anything,
right.
No,
right.
In the Army. I was singing, and I was an athlete. I played football and that basketball, and that took me out of, you know, you went into your own training barracks, and it was like being in college. You were very special.
Oh.
You had 24-hour access to the mess hall. You stayed in separate barracks where the teams stayed.
Really?
Yeah. And we traveled all over Europe and played football, basketball, and then I won the Army Talent Contest, and I traveled all over Europe some more.
I see. So, so you had an interest.
2 years, 2 years I played football, basketball, and sang.
That's very funny.
Yeah.
And what did you do in the Army?
That's what I did.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
All right, okay, good.
Yeah.
So now you're...
25 or 6 when I came out.
Right. Maybe it's time to start thinking about what you're going to do with your life.
I immediately started. I got my first big role in a professional theater. I played at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. I played Miles Gloriosus, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
Well, wait a minute. No studying. You haven't studied at all.
Oh, yeah, just voice.
Yeah, but no acting.
Oh, no. I've never taken an acting lesson. No.
You're kidding.
No.
Amazing.
I'm put off by that, too. Actually, I'm sort of put off by the idea of any person, man, particularly, telling me what to do. I don't really cotton to that. And so I learned on my own, you know. I used to listen to Gordon McRae and John Raitt and all those people, and I thought, hell, I can do this. they're all lousy actors, and
mm-hmm.
all they do, but they sing good.
Yeah.
And I already do that. So I'm going to be fine. And then I heard Man of La Mancha, and I heard Richard Kiley, and I got really scared. I had to learn to act. And I did, you know, self-taught, but I buried myself in books about acting, and I never took any classes or anything. But I knew that it wasn't enough to just be a singer, because
mm-hmm.
he set the bar very, very high, and I was awestruck by him. And then I started working in local theater and doing local musical reviews, and I worked at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, and it just fed on itself. This guy called me. His name was Paul Simon, by the way. And he used to work for KDKA Television, which was the Dumont television network back in the beginning. And he went to New York to work on the Merv Griffin Show. And he called me and said, I've got you an audition for the Griffin Show if you'll come into New York. And I said, I would love to. And in the meantime, we had done this little musical review that was so good that we got to take it to New York and do a few nights at the Bonsoir, which was a famous place.
Yeah.
And because we did that, there was an agent there named Irvin Arthur, and he signed us all with CMA, and then we all went home. So we had New York agents, but we all went home. But he signed us all,
because
he kind of saw some. So when I got the call from Simon to come to New York, I called Irvin Arthur, and I said, listen, you're my agent. I'm doing this audition for the Griffin Show this afternoon. Would you come and hear me and represent me? And he said, I can't, but why don't you come into my office, bring your piano, bring your accompanist and come to my office first before you go there and sing me something, because you were part of a group and I, you know.
I don't remember
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you didn't remember
right,
me.
Right,
for,
right.
He didn't really know what I did. So I sang him a couple of songs and he looked at me and he said, this is really weird. You are so right for a musical that's happening in Greenwich Village right now. It's called Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris. Are you interested? And I said, well, I'm interested in anything, but I don't know Jacques Brel from A Cake of Soap. He said, well, would you go and would you audition for them? And I said, yeah, I'm here. And so that was set up. Then I went to do my audition for the Griffin Show. And the pianist talked me into singing first, which is a big mistake, because they came down about number six, and he said, you ready to go? And I said, I already sang. And he said, George.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, my God. He brought Griffin and Arthur Treacher and everybody down to hear me.
Yeah. Oh.
I had already sung. My accompanist was gone. I went out into the afternoon. You know, I can't tell you what my psychological position was at that moment in time. I've maybe never been angrier than that at myself.
Because you didn't know?
Yeah. And because I let that guy talk me out of going in the position that they had given me.
Right.
And they had given me that position specifically, but I didn't know that. So I thought, oh, he has another audition, and I'll sing now. And so by the time I got to the audition that evening at the Village Gate, I was not about to take any crap from anybody.
Right.
And the stage manager came in and said, so where's your accompanist? Where's your accompanist? It's things, we've got to get going here. We've got to get, and I said, look, just get out of my face. Go away. My accompanist shows up, I'll sing. If he doesn't, I won't. Don't bother me. He showed up. I got up on the stage and sang. With great, great anger and passion.
Yes.
Songs that didn't necessarily deserve
call
it, but I
it,
gave
right?
it to them.
It's right. But it's so right for the... You're right!
That's exactly right. And they called me down off the stage and said, so we'd like you to do the show. Are you interested? And I said, I have no idea. I don't know who Jacques Brel is. I don't know what the show is. And I'm saying to myself, besides that, I'm scared to death. And they said, well, would you stay and see the show? Because we'd like you to be in it. I said, I will. And I sat down, and I immediately became even more frightened. And that material was like, what the hell is this? I never heard anything like this in my life. It was passionate. It was fabulous. It was smart. It was political.
Yeah,
was,
right.
All those things. And talking about love and, you know, serious love, grown-up love, not...
Yeah, right.
Not puppy love. And I want to do this show, except I'm hyperventilating. I have to go. I went out and I walked around the block, and I walked around the block, and I walked around the block. By the time I got back, the second act was half over. But I couldn't go back in the building. I had to settle myself. And I sat and watched the rest of the show, and Eric Blau came up to me and said, so what do you think? And I said, yes, I want to do it. And he said, okay, go home, we'll call you. And
wow.
That was it. So I went back to Pittsburgh and waited for the phone to ring.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And
so a screwed-up audition for the Griffin Show, which would have been, I mean...
Yeah, right, exactly, been, right. Know, right, it sets you up.
It set me on the path to really seriously considering what kind of music I wanted to sing, what I wanted to do with my, quote, career, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, probably I've done 3,000 performances of that show.
Really?
Yeah. And it changed everything. It changed how I perceived what I wanted to do. And from that moment on, it was not about being a nightclub singer or somebody in a band or anything like that. It was about theater. It became my career for the next 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Every major American city, I did it. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but when they would send a company out, they would send out the A-team or the B team. I was always on the A team. Mm-hmm. For every major production that was done, I was part of those productions.
Wow.
I just took it to mean, you know, sort of right place at the right time, but it was more than that, because by the time the show closed in New York, there were 50 people who had sung that show. But the big important ones was Robert Guillaume and me, mm-hmm. Joe Maciel, a couple of others, but I did every one.
Wow.
Every one.
Wow.
And then we came to Los Angeles, and I was auditioning for television, but I didn't like television. I felt about it the way I felt about opera. Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It put me off, and it made me feel bad. And I did some television, and I did, you know, 12 TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
But theater was the thing. And then I started getting the really good roles, you know. And all in a row, I got Little Night Music, mm-hmm. Sweeney Todd, Man of La Mancha, 1776, Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm-hmm.
And then one morning the phone rang, and it was Carolyn Burns, who runs the Rubicon Theater with her husband, Jim. And she said, I had this dream last night, and you were on stage doing the lead in All My Sons, the Arthur Miller play.
Oh, my.
And I said, that is so stunning to me, because that play, when I was a kid, that play had a profound effect upon me and the way I looked at the world. And the thing about morals and ethics.
Yes.
And it was the lesson, one of the huge lessons of my young life. And I even saw the movie with Edward G. Robinson, and even at the time I went, so wrong. Nobody else would do it because, you know, it's the guy's...
Right.
Oh, he did a terrible thing.
Yeah.
And, but it was, she said, you want to do it? And I said, Christ. Yeah. And so we got nominated for an Ovation Award. The play won an Ovation Award as the best play. The Sweeney that we did was voted one of the top 10 musicals of the year 2000. And it's been like that. That's it. So, and then we have our theater, you know, where we work all the time. You know, I've done maybe 14 productions.
You mean the Rubicon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then I started doing voiceovers, and, you know, and so it's just
and then,
unfolded.
Yes, and then apparently somebody talked you into making a CD.
Well, Amanda and Michelle have been hawking me for 20 years.
Oh, my God.
I'm seriously mean it.
Uh-oh.
When are you going to do the album? When are you going to do the album? When are you going to do the CD? I said, I'm not thinking about that now. I'm thinking about other things. When it's time, I'll do it. And then finally, Michelle said, I have a lot of time, and you're not doing anything right now. Can we get started mm-hmm. on this? And I went down to her house, but she said, I want to play this for you and see if you like it. And it was Save the Last Dance. Mm-hmm. And it was this arrangement that she did. And she played it for me, and I went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, I can do this. I can do this. And so we went into we did that. That was the first thing we did. And then we put together a group, you know, piano, bass, guitar, drums. And we went into the studio, and we worked for a day, and we recorded 5 songs, and I brought them home, and I listened to them, and I went, this is shit.
Oh.
This is really shit.
Oh, dear.
It's way over the top. It's not, there's nothing intimate or personal about it. It's performing. It's not real.
It's that thing you hate.
You got it.
I know.
You got it.
I know.
And so I went, I called Michelle, and I said, we have to talk about this tomorrow. And we talked, and I said, I want to redo all these. And so a couple of these things I'm going to throw out, and we have to even redo the arrangements. But 3 out of the 5 of them, I have to re-sing them. Like September song, it was like, what? Get over yourself. And so we started narrowing it down and defining what it was we were trying to do.
Yeah, see, that was the question I wanted to ask, because I was sure that you had a vision for what you wanted.
I didn't, but we got the vision as we started. And the truth is, that's the only way we could have gotten. And we started getting it down. We started getting it personal, and then when I started choosing other songs, and I tell you.
You're happy. I'm assuming that what you were aiming at, because you used the words, it's intimate and it's real and it's powerful and passionate. Is there an overall theme of the song? Or?
You know, the only thing about it is, and this is the other thing that I came to as we were doing it. June 3rd, I'll be 80 years old.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And I want this to be some kind of a statement about where I am in life right now and how I look at things.
So it's your vision. It's your take on the world and life.
But with the brilliance of Michelle Brauerman and Stefan Oberhoff.
Yes, right. I'm glad you said it.
It cannot be minimalized. I mean, what they have done. Well, what we did together when once we got on the same page, we were like, yeah. Oh my God! Oh my God! It's like that. Yeah. And so, that's right. So, I figure I did it. They said, why haven't you done before that? I said, because I wasn't supposed to.
Right.
I did it now because I was supposed to do it now.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't have to say, I'm sorry I didn't do it before, because I'm not.
No.
I did it when I was ready to do it and when I was supposed to do it, when I thought I had something emotionally to say.
Yeah.
About who I am and what I want people to hear.
The whole idea of being congruent with yourself, being who you really are. That's actually the theme of the show I do, and one of the reasons that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art is because when you hear people like you talk about it, you can hear what it sounds like to be really committed to who you are, to be being who you are. And so this description of, the whole description of your life, about how you knew at every minute, this works for me, this doesn't work for me. I like this, I don't like this. This is where I want to be, this is not where I want to be.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It's funny, I never really quite looked at it that way, but if you go back over it, you're right.
Yeah.
I just told you the pathway.
That's correct.
That it was.
You knew at every turn.
Yeah, I guess I did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people would say, you're a fool. You could have had a big career in opera. Well, I obviously didn't want a big career in opera.
No, I think that's right.
Otherwise,
I think that's right. Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting to me is not only did you always know, and did you honor it, it's really lovely. I mean, you didn't, you weren't vacillating. Oh, should I, shouldn't I, this is this, that, no, you knew. But the other thing that's really interesting to me is that there were those moments, especially, dramatically, when you heard Jacques Brel, that you wanted it, you knew it was right for you, you were frightened, but that didn't stop you, you know?
Yeah.
So that even when you were scared, you could see, this is for me, this is mine, I want this. You know?
I'll tell you a little story about Brel when they said, okay, finally they called me and said, come to New York.
Yeah.
We're going to put you in the show. And I got there, and we had the first day of rehearsal, and I hadn't even met the director yet. The stage manager was putting us in. And at the end of the day, Eric Blau, who was, his wife was the star of the show, and he and Mort Schumann had done the translations and so on, and he was the producer, came to me and said, we want you to sing both male roles. The one male role is really big and gutsy and, you know, take bites out of flesh. And the other one is younger and more romantic. But your voice can cover the older one, and you're completely right for the younger one. So with both of those,
we can use you whenever we want.
Exactly. Exactly. They knew it. They knew that. I didn't know that. And they gave me the music. And what I did was I would work on the material from the time I came home from rehearsal right after dinner. I'd go get myself a sausage sandwich with onions on it. I'd go lock myself in that apartment. I would work on it until 2 or 3 in the morning. I'd go for a walk. I'd come back. I'd get 4 or 5 hours sleep. I'd get up and go to rehearsal. By the end of 1 week, I knew both roles.
Yeah, this is the boy.
And I knew all the harmonies.
This is the boy who could listen to the radio and then and have it, right?
Yeah.
And this is a question I meant to ask you before. Can you read music?
No. So I mean, yes, I can read it.
I don't know what the notes are. Right?
But I know what the spaces are. So I can read music to the point where it serves me.
Right. So you weren't. So what you were learning was you were listening to it and learning it.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Yeah.
You were picking out the harmonies from listening
yes,
to the.
Yes. But then I also had the sheets.
Oh, but you had the sheets, right?
And then
right,
I
right.
would find what harmony line was mine, and then I would hear it
And what you mean when you say I would hear it, you mean you would pick it out of the what everybody else was singing.
Yeah, as long as I could find it on my sheet. When I found it on my sheet and I would hear what that line was, if I was singing the bass line on the harmony for Marika, for example, which is a solo for the woman, but the whole chorus backs her up. Or like Old Folks, which is, the tenor's going, la-dee-da-dee-da, and the bass is going, la-dee-da-dee-da. When you're finding those, if you have it on the paper, you can find it because they
told
me. I'm
sorry. You're saying this as though anyone could do that.
I don't know. I never thought about it.
Well, I know. Mm. Everyone couldn't do that.
Yeah.
That is a pretty remarkable skill for someone who really doesn't actually read the music, just to identify the line and then hear it in the, when four people are singing, right?
Yeah.
And you can hear that line because you can see it going up and down.
It's
amazing. It's amazing.
It wasn't, but...
I know it wasn't.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, I know.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
It's amazing. It's amazing, right? But, so what did they do? They gave you the sheet music and they gave you a record?
They gave us a cassette of a performance.
Jesus,
a complete performance. And
Very lucky.
Oh.
I mean, because they knew you could sing the role. Did they know you could learn the role? I mean,
well, that's what they said. That's
stuff.
Why they brought me. They just said, we want you to learn both roles. When I look back on it, they were completely in shock when I learned both those roles.
I'm sure they were.
Because what they did then was that the first rehearsal was on a Saturday. We rehearsed Saturday and Sunday. We had Monday off. Then we rehearsed Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The following Tuesday, I went on in the younger role.
Oh, my goodness.
And the night after that, I went on in the older, the first role.
Yeah, they were...
In two consecutive nights.
I'm sure they were blown away.
I was blown away.
Yeah.
I think they were.
I'm sure they were.
I mean, I think that's why, I never questioned it, and I never... I never thought about, all I sensed was, there's no political bullshit going on here. This is, the best people are getting these positions,
Yeah.
And when they came to me and said, we're sending a company to the Happy Medium in Chicago, and we want you and Robert Guillaume, and they named the two women to be the leads.
Right.
Well, I knew that. I knew because there were, there were 15 or 20 other singers at that point. And I knew, gave me a plum.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not because you're somebody's lover.
That's right. But they also gave it to me because that show, you were only allowed to sing 6 shows a week. And so they weren't understudies, they were alternates.
Right.
Because you weren't allowed to sing more than 6 out of the 8. So what they did was, on Guillaume's night off, I sang that role, the bigger role.
Right.
The rest of the time, I sang the younger guy role, and then the younger guy role was covered by somebody else who was the younger guy.
When you were off.
When I was off, yeah.
Amazing.
And so that's
they
how
had
it worked.
You. Guillaume couldn't do the younger role.
Oh, no.
So, but they had you.
Yeah.
You could do both.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, they must have been tickled to have you.
Oh, shit, they were. And that's how they used me in, we did Chicago, Los Angeles, Stanford, San Francisco. And each time, that's the way they did it, because they would never see a lesser guy.
Yeah, right. Right.
And that was right. That was smart enough. I didn't think it at the time. I just thought, wow, I get to see
it. Yes, I get to do it. Right. Do you have plans for this CD? Are you going to do a...
Oh, yes, my God. The official release date is July 8th. It'll be released to Amazon, iTunes, and LML Music. I think that there are a couple of things on it that if they get to the right ears will go viral. I really do. The Sum Enchanted Eden, you've never heard like this. Because people don't hear that song anymore. All they hear is, Sum Enchanted Eden. And I said, we have to find a way, because the lyrics to this song are
so beautiful.
Fabulous.
I know.
I want people to listen to it again, to hear it again. And some people have said, oh my God.
Right.
I just heard that song for the first time. I've never heard that song before.
Wow.
And that's Michelle and her brilliance. So we got to figure out a way to do it. And we did. You know.
I ask one more question. And that is, having given a life to this work, to the work of music, to the work of acting, to the work of portraying honestly, what would you say about that? Anything?
I've often thought about that. Because I was a, hey, look at me, Mom. Look at me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I was that before. I jumped off the diving board and said, hey, look at me, Mom.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I did all that stuff. It wasn't just singing and acting.
Right.
It was in there, and fortunately I found ways to get it out, and people helped me along the way. Looking back over where it has brought me to, like, right now, sitting here at this table, I'm grateful that I chose what I chose. And the other part of the equation is that I think that I needed to have a partner, and I couldn't have a better partner. Very, very, very crucial. An agreement early on. I want for you what you want for you. You have to want for me what I want for me. And as long as we can keep that, then I can have my cake and eat it too, you know.
I do. And this is my bias, but I think too many people within couples are saying, whether they're saying it out loud or not, I want for you what I want you to have. I want, you know, I want you to be who I want you to be.
Yes, that's exactly right.
You know,
that's exactly right.
And it's death, of course.
Yeah. Oh, it's
death. And to be able to say, I want for you what you want for you, even if it turns out that it's not exactly what I would have wanted for you, because you
and
want
even
it.
If it doesn't work out for
and
you.
And even if it doesn't work out for you, that's right.
That's right. Yeah, yes, and you can never, ever, ever say, see, I told you.
No.
You can never do that, because if you live up to that, you won't even think it. Because it's not part of the equation.
That's right, it's not part of the equation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to say.
Well, it's a break, you know.
It's rare.
Yeah.
It's rare.
Yeah.
It's rare. And I would venture to say, although I can't prove this, that if it's rare in the population at large, in the industry that you're in, you know, rare doesn't actually cover it.
But we know a few, you know. Uh-huh. We do. We know a few.
Yeah. Okay, so you're grateful. It's interesting, because you were so, essentially, although I don't think you thought about it in this way, you were so proactive in terms of who you were and what you got.
Oh, I've always chastised myself for not being proactive enough.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've always felt guilty that I didn't work hard enough.
You didn't work hard enough?
Well, no. I mean, from the standpoint of, look, there are all these measures of how you're judged and so on and so forth.
Ah, I see.
So I'm not a, by any standard, I'm not a big star. But also, by any standard, I'm as good or better than most of them.
I believe you.
And I know that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's okay with me. Mm-hmm. Because I have a life. I've had a life.
Yes.
A really, really good life.
Yes.
And so what do I have to be?
Yes.
Although, on occasion, I've gone, George, you should have, it happened to me yesterday. Amanda and Michelle are doing this Land Before Time things.
Mm-hmm.
And they called me and said they wanted me to read for a couple of things, voiceover-wise, and I did. And then she sent me an email yesterday saying, you're right for Mr. Threehorn, they're all dinosaurs. And would you read that? So I read it, and I made an MP3, and I sent it to her. Then I got an email back saying, wow, and never having heard the character, you were really close. Now here are some references. Go and look at these little films. These are cuts of that character.
Right.
And make those adjustments and do it. And then I sent a thing back saying, I assume you mean I should do another one. And she said, yes, please. And I got this thing in the pit of my stomach going, are we going to, because there was something in there about the girl saying, oh, does that mean I'm not going to work with so-and-so next week? And I thought, what the hell does that mean? Do they already have this cast and they're just fishing or what?
Right.
But that wasn't the case. But I asked Amanda and she knew the answer to that. So I did a new one this morning, mm-hmm. and sent it to her, and she said, half an hour, she sent me an email and said, you nailed it, I'm sending it to the producers.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'll either get it or I won't.
Right.
But there was a moment of great reluctance yesterday.
Yes. What I hear is that powerful resistance to the politicization, to the manipulation, to the it's not fair, that's so strong in you.
There you go. I didn't think that at all, but you're absolutely
don't
right.
Don't you see it?
Yeah, I do.
You're right.
I do.
So you couldn't play in the arena where that would have been, and it would have been in that arena, the one you didn't play in.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't have. So what it says to me is that the talent was so big, you could have a life in this work, even though you wouldn't go and play in those arenas. You could make a life. You could have a paying career doing this.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
You know?
I do. And that's true.
Yeah.
That's absolutely
the other was not an option because your intrinsic sense of right and wrong and your abhorrence, unfair, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a side of it. That's definitely a side of it. That's the thing that sort of, that makes my stomach start churning.
Right, right,
I recognize that for what it is.
Not going there.
But the other part of it is, and especially as it applied to television, was, why am I making such a big deal out of this?
I just want to tell you that he's got his hand over his eyes and he's shaking his head.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. You can't do that.
That's right.
You can't do that. You had... You know, and it's even if you talk about, all my sons, that even as a boy, what stood out for you, what was dramatic for you, what spoke to you was this morality tale. That is an integral part of George Ball.
Yes, it is.
You know?
Yes, it is. That's very true.
So, it had to have meaning. It had to have relevance. It had to be significant for you to want to do it.
Well, the other side of that, which is mildly self-destructive, is I don't want to have to prove myself.
Right.
Just give me the job and you won't be sorry.
You won't be sorry, right. And don't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
There was a little of that in there, too.
Yeah.
Right. So given who you are psychologically, I think you made of this life what could be made of it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
You know?
And it's, some of it has been challenging. I mean, All My Sons was that was really scary to learn that and think that I could do it. But not only did I learn it and think that I could do it,
yeah,
I could do it.
Yeah.
I really could do it. So
you found him in you.
I did. I found him in me.
Yeah.
A lot of him was my own father.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised to hear that, actually.
Yeah.
Of course, that is some of how you arrived at the psychological profile you've got.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, I mean, we are not separate from our history.
No.
You know?
We sure as hell aren't.
No, we definitely
no,
are
we
not.
We are not.
No. Well, all right. This has been quite remarkable.
In my experience, most people are not able to honor even their very strongest impulses. This works for me, this doesn't work for me, I like this, I don't like this. If other people seem to think that it should work for you, if other people have done it because they believed it should work for them, so many of us are driven by what the world thinks, our parents think, our loved ones think, our peers think, the television tells us, our religion tells us, the culture tells us. There are so many voices in our head about what we ought to be, and the risk of losing the approval, the affection, the attention, the love, the security of those other people is such a potent factor in what so many of us decide to do in our lives that few of us are able to see through that and take the risk to be who we are. The risk of not doing what the important others think we should do. So when you hear someone like George, just about to turn 80, this is a story of a man who simply knew and was not swayed, however much, as he says, he may have second-guessed himself. And I want to make a plug for that relationship, too. I don't want that to go by too quickly. The idea that a lasting, powerful, important relationship is one in which we are able to honor what the other wants for themselves. I think that, too, is quite rare. Anyway, I hope that you have asked yourself, what was I drawn to that I didn't go to because I thought it wasn't right for me or I shouldn't do it? Or what did I do that I really didn't want to do because I was afraid not to do it because I thought somehow it was the right thing to do, even though my insides were screaming, no, no, no. And if you did have that experience, if you are willing to take a few moments to go back over the thing that you missed, the thing that you did that perhaps you wouldn't do again, and ask yourself if maybe you can redo it, undo it, do it differently. So, as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, something that intrigued you, something that tickled you. I found quite a lot amusing in this interview. Or maybe it is just what is coming, and that is the extraordinary pleasure of listening to this beautiful cut from George's CD. And by the way, if you want to get George's CD, please email me at thelinshow.com, and I will pass that information on to George, and you can get a copy of Think of Me, which includes this absolutely gorgeous version of Some Enchanted Evening. So we're going to go out on that, and here, Michelle Brauerman's beautiful arrangement, George Ball's amazing interpretation of Some Enchanted Evening.
Some enchanted evening, you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room, and somehow you know you know, even then, that somewhere you'll see her again and again. Some enchanted evening, someone may be laughing. You may hear her laughing across a crowded room. And night after night as strange as it seems, the sound of her laughter will sing in your dreams. Who can explain it? Who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons. Wise men never try. Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you hear her call you across a crowded room, then fly to her side and make her your own. For all through your life you may dream all alone. Once you have found her, never let her go. Once you have found her, never let her go.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some guy.